You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, teachers are organizing and striking in a number of different states. What do they want and are they poised to get it? A labor historian in West Virginia calls the late February strike there that ended with a new contract one of the most important strikes in the state's modern history. An Oklahoma City teacher named Katrina Ruff saw what West Virginia did and made a sign for her protest on Monday in Oklahoma that said, "Thanks to West Virginia." Ruff told the New York Times, "They gave us the guts to stand up for ourselves." In Kentucky, teachers didn't show up on Monday in their classrooms in a coordinated protest, and they demonstrated in front of the state capitol. They're protesting changes to the teachers' pension plan. In Arizona, where K-12 educator pay ranks 43rd in the country, teachers are calling for a 20% pay raise and threatening to strike. And remember that St. Paul teachers were poised to strike until a new contract satisfied their demands. Now, keep in mind that teachers in places like West Virginia and Oklahoma and Kentucky and Arizona have endured low pay and low investment in public schools for years. So why now? What is it about this moment, economic or political, that's inspiring this level of activism? Our guests are going to answer those questions. I'd like to hear from you as well. If you're a public school educator, what's the larger message that these teacher strikes are sending to state leaders and American voters as a whole? And for the rest of us who are not public educators, public school educators, is striking an acceptable tactic for teachers in your view? Are teachers using the appropriate tools to get what they want? So I want to hear from you if you're a public school educator. Also want to hear from you as an American taxpayer about how you're viewing these demonstrations and these tactics that teachers are using. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter. I've tweeted out a question on this. It's at Carrie NPR. Richard Ingersoll is with us. He's a professor of education and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's with us today from Philly. And Richard, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Carrie.
John Shelton is with us. He's an assistant professor of democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and he studies labor unions there, and he's with us from Green Bay. And John, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much. I really appreciate the invitation.
John, I want to talk about how West Virginia teachers specifically launched the movement and some of the techniques that they used. But first, is this a case, do you think, of teachers in other states seeing the arguments and the tactics that West Virginia made and saying, if they can do it, we can do it too? Is that why this has spread?
Oh, I think absolutely. You know, the interesting thing, so I do historical work on teacher unions and teacher strikes. And, you know, there was a really pretty substantial era, I call it the era of teacher strikes in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And one of the things that teachers learned, now most of those strikes were centered in urban areas, places like, you know, Philadelphia, where Richard is. But what teachers often found in those cases is even when they went on strike against the law, there was very little that authorities could do to discipline them. They couldn't fire them. They couldn't arrest them. And so I think we're seeing that here. I mean, the interesting thing about West Virginia is it started very small with three counties, and then it escalated, you know, very quickly. And when teachers, the most important thing about that strike, I think, is that teachers were able to win, right? So even though it was illegal for them to strike, they won that strike, and the state gave them a significant salary increase. And so other teachers who are in similar situations, like Oklahoma and Arizona, as you mentioned, are seeing this and saying, we can do this too, because we have an enormous amount of leverage.
Richard, this is interesting what John is saying about even if you have to go up against the law, teachers have used these tactics before and succeeded. I mean, you know that many of these states are right-to-work states. You know, collective bargaining is outlawed, or unions just don't have a lot of power. What does this moment tell you about that?
Well, the idea is, yes, it may be illegal, but the model is kind of Gandhi's civil disobedience, in a sense, that, look, sometimes if you break the law, yes, you have to suffer the punishment, but it wins the larger victory, and that's what John's speaking to. And some states it's legal, and some states it's not. But typically in states where there aren't strong teacher unions or there's not collective bargaining, the pay is much lower in general.
A call here from Kim in Minneapolis. Hi, Kim, you're a teacher?
Yeah, I teach in Minneapolis public schools. My name is Kim. I think this is the moment to really stand up for public education. We've been tolerating a slow drip of resources away via charters and other kind of programs that are taking away from our public schools. And people need to understand that a free public education is the hinge pin of a democratic society. And if we are going to continue to deplete public education, then we're going to go back to, you know, where rich people can afford to educate their children and poor people are just out of luck. So I think now is time to strike back.
So Kim, thanks for the call. John, I want to pick up on what Kim just said there. Now is the time. I mean, as I said in the introduction, teachers in some of these states have endured low pay for a long time. I mean, I used to live in Oklahoma. The teacher pay was terrible then and is still terrible now. Why now?
Well, again, I think we've seen this. There's been obviously an enormous amount of frustration. I mean, you look at Oklahoma, West Virginia, these places. These are states that they're deeply red states. In many cases, unions, especially public employee unions, don't have a lot of rights. And it's no coincidence that these are also states that have disinvested the most in public education. Now, the caller made a really excellent point, which is that this is happening everywhere, even in states like Minnesota. But in states that are red states, it's been even more pronounced. And so I think there's been this very longstanding simmering frustration. And I think, again, seeing the example of teachers in West Virginia has really, in a lot of ways, kind of opened the floodgates. And the other thing I would just pick up on what the caller said really quickly is that Americans have a long history of supporting public education. I mean, if there's something really to be proud of in the United States, if people are looking for something, which I don't have to look that hard, but if people are looking for something, we were the first country to ensure that all of our citizens by right had access to public education, all of our kids had access to public education, and that it was a means to facilitating democratic citizenship. So I think people in these teachers and parents in these states are understanding what these years of disinvestment have done to the conditions under which teachers teach and by extension under which students learn. And I think that's why we're seeing this upsurge right now.
You know, Richard, I wonder if there's what John just described here intersecting with a kind of a political moment that we're in, right? I mean, we've seen lots of demonstrations. We've seen student activism after the shooting at Parkland. Do you look at this and say there's something else happening with the environment and that's intersecting with teachers putting up with low pay for a long time?
I do. But when I look at the larger context of environment, what I see is we've had 15 years of accountability. And this started before No Child Left Behind Act. And what happened is that and accountability is not necessarily bad. I mean, I'm a parent of kids who go to the public schools and a taxpayer. And so we had this accountability movement and far more pressure was put on schools in general and teachers in particular. But the problem was that quite often it was a reform done to teachers and not with them.
Uh-huh.
And when we increased the responsibility and accountability, we didn't necessarily increase the support, the autonomy, the authority, the means to meet the higher bar. And we also didn't increase the rewards. And so in a sense, it's been kind of a one-sided reform over the last 15 years. Far more responsibility, expectations, and accountability on teachers. And to some extent, I think there's a great deal of frustration, which is that, look, you know, you're blaming us for all these school problems. And yes, we have some responsibilities here, but why not, one, give us the tools to do the job, don't micromanage it. And the second thing is, what about some rewards along with this increased responsibility?
Richard, given what you've just said, I'm wondering how you think teachers and the unions that represent them saw the 8 years of the Obama administration. I know there was some friction between the teachers' union and the Obama administration. Is some of this coming from, well, we thought there'd be some of those gains and those changes that you've just mentioned, and we really didn't see much change during those 8 years? What's your sense?
Yes, those were very odd years in the sense that teachers traditionally have voted, and the teacher unions very supportive of the Democratic Party, and yet a lot of this accountability was enhanced and increased under the Obama administration. It wasn't that the Obama administration was anti-teacher, although I'm sure many teachers and unions felt very uneasy with that, particularly, enhanced teacher accountability.
Right.
But again, there's sort of this one-sided aspect. Okay, hold us more accountable, but what about, one, the tools to do the job, and two, the rewards? That's where I think there's been a build up in frustration in teachers in general.
On Twitter, listener Mark says, red states general poorer states with lower teacher pay. How are the outcomes? Are the kids learning? Are red states less well off because of their failure to fund schools? John, I don't know if you have some insight on that or whether Mark's just posing some rhetorical questions here.
Well, I think that's a really great question that Mark poses. I would actually pick up on the question and think about the historical context of that. And it actually, seeks pretty well with some of the stuff Richard was just saying. One of the reasons for this notion of accountability is that increasingly in the last 30 or 40 years in the United States, much of our narrative about economic opportunity comes from this idea of ensuring that students have the proper education, right? I mean, mm-hmm. You often hear this mantra of human capital that, we have to raise kids that can become the kind of workers who can compete in a global marketplace. Well, it kind of cuts both ways, actually, right? Because, and some of the stuff Richard was saying, right? If we expect that if this is going to be such an important thing and we're holding teachers accountable, then we need to give them the ability to do the things that they need to do, and we need to reward them when they do a good job. And so I think what you're seeing, to go back to Mark's question, is in states that are poorer states and as an aggregate and where there might be less economic opportunity, I think that's part of the reason why you're seeing at least a decent amount of parent support in those states. I mean, I was reading an article this morning where a parent basically said, if this helps my kid, in the long run, I'm okay to find alternative, babysitting arrangements for a couple of days. And so I think there is a realization in some of those states. I actually think it's kind of problematic that we put so many of our eggs in the basket of developing, sort of human capital development. But if we're going to take that rhetoric at face value, that makes teachers incredibly important, right? And even in those states that may have lower tax resources.
Yeah, I think we're hearing that also in this conversation already. KJ says on Twitter, not a teacher, but a parent of kids in public school, I 100% support teacher strikes because it's the only real leverage they have to get change. And it's not just about low pay. Their ultimate reason for doing it is for better education for our kids. To Teresa in Grand Meadow. Hey, Teresa. Hi, and thanks for waiting.
Yes.
What'd you want to say?
Teresa.
Right.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I guess I'm just thinking too, I'm for the teachers getting fair wages and striking like they are.
Mm-hmm.
I believe or know that, it is a 9-month job, that they have versus us, out full time or, working 12 months out of a year and, hearing, a lot of them have like a part time job, their wages, it's based on a 9 month. I'm seeing, that's not a very good point because it's a 9 month job versus a 12 month. And if they need a supplement job for those 3 months between, yes, they should.
Let me ask you this, because I think you're speaking to this. I mean, do you think teacher pay overall, average across the country, I think is $52,000 for a teacher's salary? Of course, some states higher, some states lower. Does that seem appropriate to you?
That seems appropriate. Yes, I work full time myself, and I was well under that.
Okay.
For 44 years.
I appreciate the call. Teresa, if I may, I'm going to go on to some other callers because we have full phone lines here to Tom in Minneapolis. Hi, Tom. What are you drawing from this moment with the teacher demonstrations?
Well, I'm all for it. I have watched education go downhill, be underfunded since Oregon and California did property tax restrictions 35 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And lived in Arizona for a while, worked in the school system there, and saw teachers struggling to make ends meet. And as a retired person, I'm happy to pay more taxes to fund education. It's
okay.
The solution to so many problems that we have.
Tom, I think you're raising something I really wanted to put to John and Richard, our guests. By the way, if you've just tuned in, it's a conversation about what to understand about this moment of teacher demonstrations and strikes and demands for higher pay and more funding into public education. As you know, strikes happening and demonstrations happening in many different parts of the country. St. Paul was on the verge of a teacher strike before they settled the contract. So we've asked Richard Ingersoll from the University of Pennsylvania and John Shelton from the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, to give us some insight on this. And John, I wanted to come back to you on what Tom was bringing up here, which is how we see the way state legislatures have used funding to public education and why that may be giving rise to, you know, this, as we said, long simmering moment. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and actually, I would actually tie in Teresa's point, which I think is a good one, and people often don't think about that, you know, teachers, you know, maybe work 9 months and have to, you know, piece together a living by working over the summer and working second jobs. You know, I think what's happened is the narrative about economic opportunity and education we've had in this country for the last 40 years has set working people against each other, right? So, like, we shouldn't be competing between whether, you know, Teresa can make ends meet and has to, whether she's working more than teachers. Both teachers and people like Teresa should be able to make a decent salary and a living wage and have health care and all the things that allow somebody to do the things that they want to do in life. You know, it's not an accident. At the very top of the hour, the news story talked about Trump going to West Virginia in order to sell these tax cuts, right?
Right.
That's what we've heard for 40 years now. We've got to cut taxes so that the wealthy can create jobs. Well, that's the kind of stuff that sets people like Teresa against those teachers, right? And I think what we need to think about is how we fund education, right? We need to think about having the wealthy that benefit from the education system as much as anyone else, because they're employing the people who graduate from high school and graduate from college. We need to ensure that they're paying their fair share. So the very interesting thing to me is that in Oklahoma, you have a deeply red legislature. I mean, the last time I think I was just checking this, the state Senate literally has like 8 Democrats out of like 50 people.
I think that's
right. And they raised taxes for the first time in like 20 years, and they raised it on the oil and gas industry. That's part of the reason that teachers are so frustrated there, is because taxes on the wealthy and corporate interests have been so low for so long, and this is the case in a lot of different places. So
yeah.
I would challenge that narrative.
Richard, I guess that's what I was asking, and John has put it well. Is the rubber meeting the road in some of these? Because as we're noting, a lot of these are low tax, red states with low teacher pay. Is the rubber meeting the road on tax policy in many of these states?
Well, we have an odd system where we have local control. It's unusual across the world in the sense that we have 15,000 some school districts, and we fund a lot of our elementary secondary education through local property taxes.
Right.
And it's an odd system. And look, I'm a former high school teacher. I want to see teachers paid more. On the other hand, you know, I have a double standard. I balk at any increases in my local property tax because I'm a homeowner. So the way we fund it in this country is a bit odd and a bit different. And of course, there's a lot of experimentation and discussion about let's have a different revenue stream for it. But One of the problems is people don't, no one likes any taxes, but they particularly dislike their local property taxes. And so that presents sort of some revenue stream problems for K through 12 education.
Jessica says on Twitter, to your last caller, teaching is not a 9-month job. Summers are full of planning and continuing education classes to keep up with licensure standards. Often teachers work 60 plus hours a week on that 9-month salary and they don't get paid for that extra time. John, I don't want to miss what you said about this. I'm hearing from a lot of people who are saying, wait a minute, it's not a 9-month job. That really isn't the point. I think I heard you saying.
Yeah, that's what I was saying there. And honestly, I would agree with the person you just mentioned, because like Richard, I actually was a teacher before I went back to grad school and got my PhD. So I know what that's like, too. And it's definitely not the case that teaching is a 9-month occupation. Right. I mean, 60-hour work weeks. You do stuff on the weekends, particularly if you teach in middle school or high school. You're going to extracurricular activities because you care about your students, and you have teachers in professional. I mean, now back to the stuff Richard was saying about accountability. Teachers are expected to do all kinds of professional development and workshops over the summer. Sometimes they're even participating in summer school, and so it really is the case that it's more than a 9-month job, but. You know what? The larger point that I was making was that even in spite of this, in places like Oklahoma, teachers are having to take on second jobs on top of all that stuff in order to make ends meet, which is just unconscionable and unacceptable.
Looking to hear from you, if you're a public school educator, what's the larger message that these teacher strikes are sending to their state leaders and American voters as a whole? And for the rest of us who aren't in public education, is striking, are these demonstrations, do you think, an acceptable tactic for teachers in your view? As you know, some teachers have been out of the classroom now for day after day. Is that a tactic that you think is worthwhile, is necessary in this moment? Maybe that's the way I ought to put it. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 on Twitter at Kerri, KerriMPR, to Edward in St. Cloud. Hi, Edward. Questions here?
Yeah, great conversation. So kind of a question slash comment. So I see education is kind of becoming more of a free market, certainly in higher education. And the reason I think that I had my impression of these charter schools getting funding is because people want an alternative. So my question is that should everybody's needs be met and the teachers get higher pay, what are we going to see as a result from as a taxpayer? What are you going to get back from that? Is there going to be a curriculum change? I mean, it's been noted several times that over the last 10 to 15 years, we've been dropping in world rankings for sciences, math,
right,
overall,
right,
and the turnout. So what are we going to get back?
Yeah. Richard, what would you say the answer to that is?
I think that's a terrific question, and I think it's a fair question. So, and my answer would be is we want to balance both. So there's nothing wrong with having expectations and accountability and saying, look, you know, why do our students score lower than these other nations? Or why is the students in my school lower than others in the state? And, you know, expecting better results. I think that's legitimate, and I think that's fine. But we need to do both. We need to kind of give the tools and give the rewards to these teachers. So, you know, in a sense, there's nothing unique about this. This is Management 101. You don't hold employees accountable for things they have no control over. On the other hand, you don't give a whole lot of autonomy and voice to employees and then not hold them accountable. You need to do both. So you give the teachers the tools, the autonomy, the resources, the support to do the job, and then you hold them accountable. We need to do both at the same time. And the problem is we seem to either do one or the other in this country. And so then we end up in kind of a bad place.
We heard from a principal named Walter who called to say the teachers can only make an impact when the community sees that there is a purpose for education. I don't think our culture values education. It's a real uphill battle for teachers and schools. If they go through college only to be a barista, they don't see the point. John, I'm so glad he called, because I was thinking as I was preparing for the show about how low teacher pay connects to low funding of education. And I wondered why this economic argument doesn't carry more weight in state legislatures, who can look around and say, who's got the Fortune 500 headquarters? Who's bringing in high quality jobs? You know, where is the economic connection to how we're funding education? That seems to be missing in some of these states with low teacher pay and not a great state economy.
Well, that's an interesting question. And I mean, in that case, you know, we'd want to think more specifically about the political economy of each state. So, I mean, if you look at what West Virginia and Oklahoma have in common, they're both, you know, based more than a lot of states. Their economies are based more on extractive industries like coal and oil and gas. But I would challenge the premise that even Republicans in those states don't value, you know, Republican-held states don't value education. I mean, in a lot of ways, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, the fact that, you know, teachers are on strike and the Oklahoma legislature passed significant tax increases when they haven't done that in some time tells you that the citizens there anyway, even if their leaders may not as much, do value education. And you know, to dovetail with some of the stuff Richard has been talking about, if there's bipartisan consensus about anything in this country, and you know that's a hard thing to find these days, I do think that at least the notion that public education is important for economic opportunity is there. The point that I would challenge, or the point I would make in a lot of these states where there has been disinvestment, is that what legislatures are asking teachers to do is to do more with less. Right, they're asking them to continue to have this very powerful you know role, but asking them to do it without professional level salaries.
John, I don't know about that though, because I mean, you in these low tax states like Oklahoma, like West Virginia, and others. I mean, this has been going on for decades. The citizens surely know that when you're paying low property taxes and low income state income taxes, that there is an effect on the other side of that. I mean, you know, what we're talking about here is this classic, do you live in a high tax, high service state like Minnesota and with all that comes with that? Or do you live in a low tax, low service state like Oklahoma? And you get, in some ways, what you pay for. And I figure the citizens are okay with that, because they keep electing people that say, yep, the lower taxes are the way to go. I think that's what Oklahomans want.
Well, I think elections are complicated. And, you know, I'm not an expert on Oklahoma politics, but, you know, I do live in Wisconsin. And, you know, we've seen a significant disinvestment in public education here. But what's really interesting is that our governor is currently up for reelection. This Scott Walker is going up for his third term here. And as part of his ramp up for getting reelected, he actually increased funding in fairly significantly for public K-12 education this year. And I think it is because, you know, you are right. People want lower taxes. And I think part of that is because we've seen ordinary working people like Teresa, people who are not teachers, who have seen their wages not go up for some time now, right? We supposedly have full employment, but workers are not seeing the pay bump, even though the wealthiest are seeing a huge windfall, not only from the tax cuts, but also from, you know, raking in enormous profits. And so I think part of this calculus for a lot of voters is, if I can't get a better job, at least I can get some tax benefits, right? At least I can get some lower taxes. But I don't think that means that they value an education any less. In fact,
I'm not saying that that's the direct conclusion. Richard, I want to bring you in on this, because you said a few minutes ago, hey, I value education, but as a taxpayer, I don't love seeing my property taxes go up. Get in and tell me what you're thinking of this.
Well, I think there's a double standard. We sort of want to have our cake and eat it too, and it does get back to the caller Teresa and her point about, gosh, I think that paying them $50,000 is enough. We've increased the expectations on teachers, and we constantly complain, we want to get the best and the brightest college graduates to come into this line of work. Well, if we want that, we have to pay more. It doesn't really matter whether it's 9 month or 12 month. The fact is that it's far lower pay than other types of work. I mean, I was a high school teacher, and then I became a professor. My starting salary as a beginning professor was over double what I ever made as a high school teacher. And we sort of want it both ways, in a sense. We constantly talk about, we want to get bright college graduates to come into teaching. Well, you have to have the rewards there to do that. Otherwise, it's kind of naive. I steady turnover, quitting, departures of teachers in this line of work, and it's a high quit occupation.
Mm-hmm.
It has higher attrition rates, quit rates, even than police. And so, you kind of get what you pay for. And if we want to have more, we have to pay the teachers more. I think it comes down to that, regardless of which kind of tax stream we use to bring in the revenue.
Richard Ingersoll with us today for this conversation about what to take away from this movement of teachers in some states demonstrating and demanding more pension investment in some cases and higher pay in others. He's a professor of education and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. And John Shelton with us, an assistant professor of democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He studies labor unions there. John, I'm interested. I was reading something that Dana Goldstein from The Times writes in her book, Teacher Wars, about sexism and pay inequity for women and how that influences what we think is appropriate for teacher pay, because it's traditionally a profession we think of as for women. Does that play any role in this, do you think?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, she's spot on in that analysis. So, you can take this back to the 19th century. And, I said earlier that our history of a robust public education system is something to be very proud of as Americans. Well, given the challenges to pay for that in the 19th century, probably the only practical way to have done that at the time was to feminize the teaching force, right? And with the understanding that women could be paid less for the same work as men. And so by the end of the 19th century, the teaching force in the United States was overwhelmingly female, and at the elementary school level, almost entirely female. Over the course of the 20th century, what's interesting is that the percentage of men in the teaching profession has basically trended with teaching salaries. So in the late 1960s and early 1970s, when the collective bargaining era is sort of initiated and teachers are getting higher salaries, the profession becomes a larger percentage of male teachers. And since the late 1970s and early 1980s, when teacher salaries have more or less stopped increasing, and then especially in the last 10 years when we've seen austerity politics, the percentage of teachers who are women has gone up dramatically. I think it's about 80% of the teaching force is now female. And so, like many other professions in which there's a great deal of expectation for workers to act as caregivers, these professions are often paid less than comparable professions with comparable levels of education. So absolutely, this plays into it.
Richard, when you were teaching, as you told us, before you went to get to become a professor, did that mean you got your master's or your PhD?
I went and got a PhD to become a professor.
Because I know a lot of teachers have their master's.
Yes. Yes,
and
some
underpaid.
Teachers have PhDs too, and that does give them and gets them typically an increase in the pay.
How unusual was it to be a male teacher in the schools that you were teaching in?
It wasn't unusual because I was in high school.
Ah.
But back to John's point, it's very unusual and increasingly unusual to find males in elementary schools, and those are totally dominated by women. And he's right also that there's been this increase in the percentage of teachers overall who are female over the last 30 years, and it's getting up there. It's not quite to 80%, but it's increasing, and this could well be tied to the fact that the pay isn't very good.
Call here from Amy in St. Louis Park. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Hold on a second. Speaker.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm calling to ask actually about this particular issue. I'm wondering, how are we going to retain the highest quality teachers if we're only going to be willing to pay them an average of $50,000 a year? And in addition to that, is there any other way of maybe supplementing that particular wage, not through property tax, but through some other revenue source?
Yeah. Richard, can you answer that?
Well, yes, and some states are experimenting with different revenue streams to pay for all that. And, you know, I mentioned this earlier, turnover of teachers and retention of teachers and what drives that. And salaries is a factor for sure, but there's these other things which wouldn't necessarily cost money, but which are strongly tied to the retention of teachers, particularly good teachers. And those are things like giving the teachers some voice, some input into the key decisions in the building, the school building, which affect their jobs. That's a management issue. That's where you know, that's a hallmark of a profession, is the professionals are experts and they have some input into decision making. And teachers often don't have that at all. And the data indicate that schools in which teachers are given more of that input have significantly better retention of teachers and lower quit rates. And it doesn't, I mean, that's something where it might be difficult to implement, but it doesn't actually cost money. So there's a lot of things we could do to upgrade the conditions of this job, make it more attractive, particularly to, you know, talented, smart, ambitious college graduates without necessarily spending more money.
Chris in Minneapolis says comparing teachers' pay to anyone else isn't fair. Most of the teachers have master's degrees. Richard, is that true, that most teachers have master's?
Over half. I think it's something like 60% have master's degrees, yes.
Okay.
But still, I mean, when you look at whether it's 9 month or 12 month, when you look at the pay for teachers, it's well below lots of other types of work. And, you know, in many cases, it's not competitive. But the other thing that hasn't been brought out is that the pay for teachers varies dramatically, not only across states, and John had pointed that out earlier, I think, but also across districts within a state. Mm-hmm. Across districts, they're right next to one another. So there's large flows, migrations of teachers from one school district to another, sort of, you know, where the pay is better.
Following the pay, of course. And Chris adds here, if you look at other folks who have professional degrees, they're severely underpaid. We need to invest more in teachers as a society. To Monica in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Monica, you're a teacher? Is that right?
I am.
Good. I'm glad you called. What are you thinking about?
Well, I'm thinking a lot of different things. I, too, have my master's, and it was something that I did because my husband was in the military, and I didn't want to – we were pretty mobile, and I didn't want to, you know, like, have to leave mid-year in the course of teaching. But I'm certainly not getting paid as I would with a master's degree in another profession. I'm making about the average right now with a master's degree. And for me, though, it's really not so much about the pay. You've talked a lot about having a voice, feeling like your opinion matters. We're asked to behave as professionals and yet not treated like them consistently. You know, there are oftentimes that teachers are asked by their administration, by their school board, you know, what is it that you want? And when we voice those things, oftentimes they're overlooked, ignored, diminished. And it certainly doesn't help that, you know, we live in a society that vilifies educators, that we only work 9 months a year, that it must be nice to have the summers off, that it, you know, that we're not doing what we really are doing, which is emotionally and mentally and physically investing in the future of our country. And most of us are in education because we love children, because we love learning, because we want to make a difference in the world. And it's hard to keep doing that.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. I thought you were going to add something else to that, Monica. I want to not miss something that, John, I think you also referred to, and Richard did too, about this idea of when the decisions are being made. And these are not just, low stakes decisions. When big decisions are being made about how curriculum is going to go and what the accountability looks like, this perception, and maybe this is true, that teachers are not in the room for it. Would you say there's evidence to say, well, that's true?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. And that case, and actually, first, I'd like to thank Monica for her service in teaching, as well as her husband in military service. And I actually think we should actually thank public educators the way that we thank our servicemen and women. But I can give you some examples from Wisconsin, actually. So after Act 10 diminished the things that unions could bargain over, which effectively they can bargain over almost nothing now. It's led to a significant amount of teacher turnover. There was just a report that came out last November, I think, from the Center for American Progress that looked at it's only been a few years, but a pretty dramatic and substantial amount of teacher turnover across districts. Now, part of that is coming from salaries, but a good part of it is coming from teachers leaving districts where they feel like their voice isn't being heard. I talked to a number of teachers in this state, and that's what I'm hearing. So I would completely echo what Monica's saying.
Let me take a call here from Hannah in St. Paul. Hi, Hannah. It's you wanted to speak to that, I think. Am I right?
Hi, Carrie. Yes, I do. No, I think there's a lot going on, right? There's not ever a one answer fits all or going to solve it. You know, I think that the missing what you guys say this morning, and you guys have a picture. My perspective is that you,
Hannah, forgive me. Your phone is cutting out. I think you said you're a school teacher and what, a union steward. Is that right?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yes.
Tell me quickly what you wanted to say before we lose you.
Sorry. So sorry about my phone. No, I just think that property taxes are a huge part of it. We have to look at funding a different way. I live in St. Paul, and I would vote no right now to a referendum in St. Paul. I don't want my property taxes going up because you talk about voice, right, and teachers' input into the system. Well, upper management and HR right now and the people I like to call in suits, unfortunately, are taking that money and making decisions without asking me as the educator how to best use it.
So Hannah, to be clear here, so you live in St. Paul. If the argument was made that if we raise your property taxes, we can invest more in education, you'd say, hold on, I don't trust that the right decisions would be made with that increase. Is that right? Huh. Richard, what do you hear in that?
Well,
I mean, she's a teacher.
I absolutely agree, and I've done a lot of research on this. I mean, this is, teachers are not treated as professionals in this case in the sense that they have voice and input into decision-making. And there's two levels. There's the kind of collective overall voice in school-wide decisions, but there's also discretion and autonomy within the classroom. And particularly the latter, we've seen that shrink with the accountability and testing era and this increase in micromanagement and standardized curricula and kind of teaching to the test, particularly in large urban school districts. And the problem is that kids vary. And if you try to have one-size-fits-all curriculum, a lot of teachers are going to say, look, that's all fine, but, you know, it doesn't work for my kids. Hold me accountable, but don't micromanage me. Don't tell me how to get from A to B. You know, let me figure that out because I'm the one on the ground working with the kids. And so those kinds of issues, we have seen that shrink over time, and it's directly tied to the increase in turnover rates of teachers.
John, I'm interested in how well you think teachers' unions have served the teachers in some of these low-pay states. I was reading an article where the reporter was making the point that in some of these places, teachers are out ahead of their unions. What's your take?
Yeah, that's... I've read similar things too, and there's been some really good reporting on this from labor reporters like Sarah Jaffe and others. I think to answer this question, you have to think about what a union is. And a union at its base is a group of people who work in the same place who are acting collectively. So it's not so much that union leaders in these states have not maybe wanted to do this kind of thing. I mean, I can't speak specifically to the leadership. But what gives unions power is having a number of people acting in concert. And so I think these spontaneous from the grassroots kind of upsurges really have given the unions power that they didn't have because they were very, in many cases in these states, were very limited in their collective bargaining rights. And, mm-hmm. and administration could basically just refuse to collectively bargain meaningfully if they wanted to. So it's not, I think it is a grassroots upsurge, but that upsurge is giving unions the power, right, and enabling them.
So are you saying that the unions didn't collectively really see these demonstrations and these strikes as a reasonable model until the teachers themselves said, well, we're at our last gasp here. This is all we have left.
No, I'm not really saying that. I mean, there's an old kind of saying in the labor movement, which is there's no such thing as an illegal strike. There's only a strike that loses.
Uh-huh.
And so I think what's happened is this upsurge from below has made the idea of a statewide strike a meaningful part of the toolkit of unions in these states, right, mm-hmm. in a way that it might not have been before. I mean, you have to imagine that a lot of these teachers who are demonstrating are probably not even members of unions in their states.
Oh, interesting.
Some of them might have even voted for Trump, possibly. I'm not saying a lot of them, but it's possible, right, that they could even be Republicans who are out on strike, because these are states where there's no agency fee agreements, there's no union security agreements in those states, and so many of these teachers may not actually even be union members. They may be joining now, but they may not have been union members.
John, really good to have you on the show. Thanks so much for the insight.
Likewise.
And the
thanks so much for the invitation.
Absolutely. Richard, I have one last call for you, and it's from John in Omaha, Nebraska. John, can you be brief, if I may?
Yeah, I just want to make three really quick points.
I don't think we have time for that.
Bill Gates and Tim Cook are two men that are at the forefront of technology and are very, very wealthy and are used to breaking up old systems.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going? How do traditional union models and traditional education models think that they can keep up in the 21st century with those two men trying to break it?
Okay. Great question. Thanks, John. Richard, that's a big question to lob at you at the end, but some initial thoughts.
Well, I think it ties into a certain amount of unease the public often has with teacher unions, maybe unions in general, that it's not just right-wing free market people who are uneasy with unions. And part of it gets back into this case where the teacher unions look and appear as if they're sort of against innovation and against change and supporting the status quo. And that, you know, there's maybe some truth to that out there. And the key example is evaluating teachers and distinguishing the really great from the good from the really poor. And, you know, we all know we've all been in schools, we know some teachers are better than others, and then we find out that the way teachers are paid often doesn't recognize
exactly
their performance and their merit and how to bring that in. And often teachers and their unions seem opposed to various merit pay schemes.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes quite rightfully so, that these end up just being favoritism. But on the other hand, can't we sort of move ahead on this and figure out what would be a good way of paying more to the really great teachers and paying less to the really poor teachers? I mean, that's a key place where the public sometimes is very skeptical of the union's opposition.
Richard, really grateful for the expertise you brought to the discussion. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And a big thank you to all the voices we had in this conversation, the teachers, others of you who were just thinking about this as somebody concerned about education and as American taxpayers. If you missed the show or you just got in on the end of it, I want to let you know you can find it on my podcast, Listen at Your Leisure. Search NPR News with Kerry Miller wherever you get your podcasts.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.